All right. And I guess with that, we will thank Monty for joining us, and we'll welcome Dr. Locke and Willie Vince and the listeners from KPTZ for our weekly, usually this is an extra fifth week special presentation. So thank you for joining us, Dr. Locke. And I don't see Willie yet, but we'll give it a chance. And I have to, you said I could have music as part of your show, and I've brought a little more music. I have to say, really disappointed by my performance a couple weeks ago. Zoom concerts are hard, you know? I mean, usually, like, the synchronicity of an audience being able to tell how the humidity has changed in the room with my flop sweat is a big part of the dialogue that's going on, so it's really hard to play in front of a screen. But I did convince my daughter to get together. We have a little band. We've called the Bruisers, but I'm thinking about taking my wife's suggestion and maybe calling it Political Suicide. You think that's a good band name? I don't know. But Carolyn, could I share my screen and play a very short video, the same song I did a couple weeks ago?
All right, hold on.
Can you see my screen?
Not yet.
Oh, no, not yet.
Your brain's so old, Greg.
Do you see it now?
Yep.
All right. Here it is, Political Suicide, playing UMass U.
One, two, ready, go.
Does everyone take their video off?
No,
I see everyone.
Uh-oh, standby.
Okay, hold on a second, Dr. Locke, sorry. I'm broken.
Broke the internet.
Yeah, not a good way.
I was thinking that last time you played that, I razzed you a little bit, but making my joke, I misrepresented the busking guidelines operating on old information, which is consistent with all my old jokes, I guess. So.
Guys, I don't know where it's at. Can you, Greg, can you try taking your video off and then putting it back on and see if it pops up? The issue happened when I took you off presenter.
Well, I can't, I'll share my screen again. Let's see. Oh. Okay. And then I'll turn it up. How about now?
Okay, I had a button. I had to put see all webcams from that. So, I'm sorry. Go ahead. We've got it.
Okay, great. Now, one more time, Dr. Watt.
Okay. We'll start again. In terms of the COVID-19 update, nationally, we're now approaching 6 million cases, 180,000 deaths. Things have plateaued a bit nationwide, also here in Washington State, where actually our case numbers are declining once again, and the reproductive number has dropped below one in both Eastern and Western Washington. And that is to say that that the rate of new cases has slowed below the level at which the epidemic is actually growing. So that's good news. It varies around the state. Places like Clark County, King County, Pierce County, they've either plateaued or they're dropping, but we're still seeing multiple outbreak areas around the state. There's a large outbreak in Walla Walla, largely driven by an outbreak at the prison there. Whitman County is experiencing an outbreak that's associated with students reconvening for at WSU. And this is a phenomenon we're seeing all over the country where, although many universities are still in online mode, students are coming back, they're living in off-campus housing, and there's been a lot of socializing and gatherings and consequent outbreaks. So it's something, it's a real challenge for college communities, college authorities to fulfill their educational missions, but to try to control and hamper this kind of natural tendency of when young people get together, they want to congregate. But unfortunately, that's an ideal situation for the virus to spread. We're anticipating this as a problem in places like Ellensburg and Seattle, where the universities will be starting up again this month, or in the month of September, actually. And, you know, we've got to do everything possible to discourage this, because whereas these young adults admittedly have low risk of complications, when these outbreaks occur, they inevitably spill out into the larger community, and including into these high-risk populations that we're trying to protect from the infection. So one of the outbreaks, much closer to home and of concern, is going on in Kitsap County at St. Michael Hospital. And St. Michael is the hospital previously known until June as Harrison Hospital, but now it's been renamed. And starting in early August, actually starting with a staff member who tested positive, there's what has now become the largest hospital-based outbreak to occur so far in Washington State. So there's 60 cases total as of yesterday, 39 staff members, 21 patients. There's massive testing going on. Over 2,000 employees have been tested. They'll be retested many times until the outbreak's fully under control. And this inevitably has impacts on Jefferson County, because we have a lot of people who get medical care in Kitsap County, visit specialists there. So far, we are told that the transmission is limited to certain inpatient situations, and they are aware of who's been exposed, and exposed individuals have been notified and are in quarantine. I know over 160 staff members of the hospital are currently in quarantine, and we're getting a lot of questions about this in Jefferson County. And right now, there are no blanket recommendations that people who have gone for care at now St. Michael's Hospital or visited specialists, if you have not been notified that you've been exposed, we're not thinking you have been exposed. So we're not recommending testing for anyone other than people who are specifically notified. And we'll keep tracking that very closely. Yes, Commissioner Brotherton.
Yeah, I'm wondering if it's the same metric for close contact, 15 minutes at less than 6 feet without a mask. Is that, do you think, still their threshold for testing, or is it more?
That's essentially it. Sometimes in medical encounters, it can be different. Shorter periods can qualify as a close contact if you're in very close proximity and something involving aerosolizing procedures is being done. So there are, but that is the general rule. You know, people, and especially when you're in a situation where everyone's masked up and the contact is less than 15 minutes, that generally does not qualify as a close contact. Where we're at in what's known, at least in terms of emergency preparedness regions, we're known as Region 2. And so Clallam County, still a fair amount of outbreak activity. Their case rate per 100,000 over the last 2 weeks, at least on the state website, is 97.4. So that's in the high prevalence range. Kitsap's currently at 58.9, and between 25 and 75 is considered the moderate. And we're actually listed, Jefferson County is listed on the state website as 21.9. Actually, our calculations are somewhat higher, and we have better data, so I think our local calculations are the ones that are accurate. But we did drop in Jefferson County from about 38 per 100,000. Now, as of today, it will drop to about 28 per 100,000. We were looking at, we might even be below 25, but we did get a new case yesterday that's occurring in our current count. So we've had 9 cases confirmed in Jefferson County over the last 2 weeks. A good news statistic is that another thing we look at is the percent positivity of all the tests we do, how many of them turn out positive. The goal is that they be less than 2%, and Jefferson County's been well below that. So in the last 2 weeks in August, it was at 1.4% and 1.5%. Or said another way, of the people we test for COVID-19, 98% plus are testing negative. So this is still a, you know, fortunately a rare kind of infection in Jefferson County. Other news, the schools are starting up. Brennan will actually start on Wednesday of this week. And they're offering kind of a full range of options to parents. So you can have 4 day a week in person. You can have a 2 days, the so-called hybrid model. And then students can attend school fully on remote or online mode if that's the parent's desire. So they're doing all the modes. The other three school districts, Port Townsend, Chimicum, and Quillacene, will be starting up next week after Labor Day. And to my knowledge, they'll all be on the so-called hybrid model, which will be 2 days a week in person, 3 days online for elementary and middle school, and at least in Quillacene and Port Townsend, high school will be online. And in Quillacene, there is going to be a high school option, at least for some students, will be doing some in-person education in Chimicum as it currently stands. I've been working very closely with the schools. I'll be meeting with the superintendents again tomorrow morning and we'll go over final plans. I'm certainly impressed with how well prepared they are, how carefully they've considered their reopening plans. And at this point, it's what I'm telling folks is the success or failure of this is going to have much more to do with what goes on outside the schools than what goes on inside. They're going to be doing what they can to prevent transmission and to quickly evaluate any students or staff who have exposure risk or who have symptoms. But students spend most of their time outside the classroom. And so what goes on at home, what goes on with those students and their activities outside of school, and probably what goes on Labor Day weekend is going to have a significant impact. And we are concerned about the upcoming holiday weekend because from an epidemic standpoint, 4th of July was a disaster. It really was the thing that set off the outbreak in Washington State and also on the Olympic Peninsula. And so we really don't want to see a repeat of that. People really let down their guard. They had big gatherings. They sort of ignored masking and distancing guidelines, and the results were all too predictable. So we're really trying to message this heavily, is this is not the holiday to have big gatherings. In fact, it's the holiday to stick very strictly to the limits of, yeah, ideally just household members only, at a maximum 5 non-household members, do almost everything outside, and even outside, it's important to be mindful of masking and distancing and hand hygiene directions. That's how we'll get through this next holiday weekend without triggering local outbreak activity and preventing it from spilling over into the schools. So there's a lot at stake. I was going to mention briefly what's going on in the vaccine front. Even though we think a vaccine for COVID-19 is still months away, probably the early part of 2021, it's going to be such a complicated endeavor that we're already starting the planning activities at state and local health departments. And the vaccine situation is very complex. There are over 170 different vaccines in development around the world. And over 7 are in phase 3 trials. That is in sort of the final trials. There's 3 big ones in phase 3 trials in the U.S., and they're the likely ones to be first out of the gate. 2 of them are what are called messenger RNA viruses or vaccines, where the vaccine kind of instructs your body through genetic signals to make particles of the virus that then produce immunity. This is a kind of a breakthrough vaccine technology. It's easy or relatively easy to make large quantities of these vaccines rapidly, but it's also brand new. There are no messenger RNA vaccines that are currently being used for humans or animals. So it's a brand new vaccine type. And then there's another slightly more conventional vaccine called a viral vector, which has a cold virus that has some COVID-19 genetics inserted in it, and that produces immunity. We're not expecting any vaccines to really be available for the rest of this year, but we're going to have to spend months preparing for this, because when it is deployed, it's going to be on a very large scale. It's going to require a lot of teamwork, state and local, and between public health and the medical care sector, because we will likely be the ones coordinating the vaccine distribution. And then moving on, questions. Perhaps Commissioner Dean first and then Commissioner Sullivan.
Great, thanks, Dr. Locke. What kinds of policies are being considered for consideration of how, basically, the kind of how and who those initial vaccinations will go to? That's the thing that keeps me up at night now, is thinking, what kind of conflict is that going to create?
Yeah, it's a real, very active debate. What everyone agrees on is sort of front of the line is frontline healthcare workers and first responders, you know, who are kind of in the highest risk of exposure. And then close behind, most people agree that high risk populations, which are, you know, people with chronic medical conditions, age, and also people of color are and Alaska Natives and American Indians, they've had disproportionate impact as well. So many people are advocating that they that the populations that have been most disproportionately impacted by the pandemic sort of have prioritized access to the vaccine. And there will have to be some kind of prioritization scheme early on, but this is by no means a settled issue, and it really tests the values of our communities, because in a purely capitalist way, it would just be, you know, kind of, it would be done based on economic competition. And that's the wrong way to handle a pandemic. You know, we want it, when vaccine is limited, we want to use it in the way that does the most good with the available doses, the most good in terms of limiting outbreaks and saving human life. Those are the real scorecards that we're using.
Yeah, I guess my question before that is testing the vaccine. And I understand we're gearing up ahead of time more than we ever have for testing a vaccine, but it seems like it should take a period of time to see how effective it is and if there's any complications. And I don't hear enough about that.
Yeah, and that's the phase three trials are happening now. Seattle is one of the areas for one of the messenger RNA vaccines is being given to people as we speak. And it's not enough, as you suggest, to measure effectiveness. You know, that's actually the easy part, is to measure whether the vaccine produces antibodies and stimulates these kind of white cells called T cells into developing immunity. Whether it actually works at a population level, that is to say, whether it really protects people against the infection or not, that's an even more difficult question to answer. And then the safety trials, that's the hardest thing of all, because, you know, most phase three trials involve 30,000 people or more. But some people have concern that, you know, there may be, if there's a complication that only occurs in 1 in 100,000 people, that's not going to be picked up in phase three trials. But it will be significant, you know, when you're giving a vaccine to hundreds of millions of people. And there's a lot of unknowns about this. You know, not all vaccines work. Not all. There's some vaccines, for instance, that have been developed that produce antibodies, but they don't protect you against the virus. In fact, they can even make the infection worse. In the case of, there are HIV vaccines and there are dengue virus vaccines that have failed in that way. So that's why most responsible scientists are saying there's just no way you can safely implement a vaccine before 2021. And then when exactly in 2021, it happens is the big unknown. I'm thinking that we really need to be prepared to do this as early as January of 21, but more likely we're looking at the early spring, kind of March or so of that year. And given the large-scale international trials, we should have the numbers to be pretty confident about safety at that point. How confident we'll really be about effectiveness is, that's just unknown at this point. You know, there could be a vaccine that kind of knocks it out of the park, effectiveness-wise, but most likely people are expecting the vaccines to be in like a 60-70% effectiveness rate, which is enough to stop a pandemic, but doesn't offer you 100% protection by any means. That realistically, that's what people are looking at. Okay, well, we had some KPTZ questions. One was about asymptomatic individuals, and do they create antibodies at the same rate as others? The answer to that is yes. People do seem to get robust antibody response, even if they're asymptomatic. How long that lasts, we simply don't know. There was a discouraging and very well documented case this last week out of Hong Kong of someone who absolutely, a healthy young man who got reinfected with a completely different strain of COVID-19. And they actually saved the original virus he was infected with so they could compare the two. And it's a definite case of reinfection in a healthy, immunocompetent person. We don't yet know what that means across populations. The question further asked do people who are asymptomatic have the same risk of long-term damage as those that have more severe symptoms? And the answer is they appear to be at much lower risk of that, but not risk-free. There are people who have had asymptomatic infections who have lung and kidney and heart damage, but that right now is very rare. Another question, sort of asking about the Tarbo Lake outbreak, and asked some very specific questions about whether people were wearing masks or following social distancing. And first of all, that outbreak appears to be over. We have four cases that we found that were definitely linked, but those individuals were linked in other ways too. So we're not absolutely certain that the transmission occurred at Tarbo Lake. What we do know is that there were reports of this sort of weekend gatherings, large groups, multiple families, kids, and at least the reports we had were that masking and distancing were really lax at those. But we were not there. We did not have direct observations. Hopefully those have stopped. Or at least people who are camping there are being much more cautious, but fortunately that did not set off a large scale community outbreak. It was contained in its early stages. There was a question about childcare facilities, which actually had been open throughout the pandemic. Initially for essential workers, but not really for anyone. And that's some good news. We have not seen any child care center documented cases in Jefferson County, nor has this really been an outbreak focus around the state. So it's not been a problem area. And it raises a lot of questions. We have a lot of unknowns about transmissibility of COVID-19 for young children. We know they get the infection. We know they have lower complication rates. But the studies are very conflicting about how contagious children are. Some studies say they're every bit as contagious as anyone else. Others say transmission is actually very low in these settings. So we simply don't know with certainty. Right now, I don't think parents should be afraid of having their kids in well-run child care centers. And the fact that we're not seeing outbreaks in those settings means that the people that are running those programs are really doing a good job in preventing transmission. There was a question about this. It says, I'm so confused about the recent CDC recommendation for asymptomatic people skipping the COVID-19 test. Will Jefferson County be following this advisory from the CDC? The simple answer to that is absolutely not. Neither Jefferson County nor Washington State. This was a very controversial thing that occurred last week, where a recommendation that purported to be from the CDC was discouraging testing of close contacts of confirmed cases. as it turns out, through public health officials in Washington State, we know a lot of people in the CDC, and they are telling us that this did not come from the CDC. This came from the White House and was an effort to reduce testing and thus reduce confirmed cases, and it's been ignored by virtually all state and local health departments. It's just wrong on scientific grounds. We know that at least 40% of cases are transmitted from asymptomatic individuals. So the notion that if you were asymptomatic, you shouldn't be tested, would mean that we would not find those 40% of cases. Unfortunately, this is yet another example of what's going on. As public health gets politicized and moves away from the science, it becomes less credible, and it really causes a lot of confusion in the public. Commissioner Brotherton.
Yeah, so I'm just curious, does this mean that we take what the CDC says about other things with more of a grain of salt, if it's making political proclamations rather than scientific analysis?
Yeah, that's the danger exactly, is that they, among traditional public health professionals, at least that's the group I would put myself in, your credibility is your most important asset. That's the thing you should never lose, because so much of what we do is just based on recommendations. We're not forcing people to do things. We're forcing, or we're recommending things, and people do them because they trust us, and they trust us because we've earned that trust. So if you lose the trust, you give away your major power, and that's what the CDC has been endangering, where the scientists are in the back seat, and these political appointees are calling the shots. That being said, CDC is still the preeminent public health science institution of the world, and it still has the best people in it. It's just that they're being muzzled, but not 100%. There are back channel communications, And the states are kind of doing this on their own. But Washington State has a clearer commitment to science-based public health policy. So when we got this directive from the CDC, I mean, our first response was you just have to shake your head and laugh. There's no way you will do this. And And since then, the CDC has backpedaled enormously on this particular recommendation, but not without damage to their credibility. And then a final question, just talking about the Abbott COVID-19 antigen tests, and there are these actually four different rapid tests now available. Their virtue is that they're quick. What you sacrifice with quickness is sensitivity. So they have higher rates of false negatives. That is to say, they're less able to pick up tests when a true positive. So we still recommend the lab-based test that can take a couple days. That has the highest sensitivity. But these rapid tests have some real applications in things like nursing homes or for instance, the Alaska fishing fleet. Now, they have the tests on the boats out in the ocean, and that's a great use for them. So they can test and prevent outbreaks on these fishing fleet boats. So organizations that have to do a lot of repeat testing of staff, that's where they make the most sense.
How much do these tests cost, and how available are they?
I'm not sure about the costs of them, actually. A lot of them have been provided by the federal government without cost. A number of the tribes, for instance, have received these for remote reservations, and they're not paying any cost for it. So I don't actually know. I believe they're lower cost than the lab-based tests. And one of the hopes is that their accuracy, their sensitivity will increase as the technology matures. Because we really do need more rapid tests. Actually, what would be a very good development is if the hospital, Jefferson Healthcare, if they could get a more reliable supply of the test reagents for their in-house testing, that we would have the best of both worlds. We'd have rapid testing and we'd have high sensitivity. So being able to do more local testing is our goal. And then I actually had a couple more questions. If we have time, is Willie going to join us today?
I saw Willie on the call.
Yeah, I'm actually not on camera, but I am on the phone. I've been here the entire time.
Okay. Well, I want to leave some time for him. I know you've got a 10:30 hearing, so maybe I should cut it off at that point.
Okay. I have one quick question for you, and that's just to follow up on last week, and I think we had another discussion about it, but you said something last week about recommending the commonly called surgical masks, and I just want to make sure that's okay for people to really rely on now. There's enough supply, and it conveys a little bit more, maybe not source control, but protection if you wear the surgical mask. So are you recommending now that those are, we see them all the time, that those are fine for the public to use out and about?
Yes, they're perfectly acceptable. They meet all the requirements. For some people, they're more comfortable, although there's some remarkable cloth masks that are out there. The designs are evolving all the time. So there's some that are super comfortable and probably do a better job in that they're larger and they seal better. They may be even more effective from a source control standpoint. But in terms of ease of breathing and filtration, the surgical masks, which was our previous standard of care, are fine to use, and they are much more available. The prices come down. You can get a box of 50 for about $15 is the current price. A lot of stores are actually giving them away if you forgot to bring a mask. So those are fine. People should either use a surgical mask or a cloth mask. We've been seeing some of these miniature face shields and things like that are available on the internet that are just completely inadequate. So some other things like net gaiters, we're not so sure about that. Some preliminary testing shows that they don't work as well as some others, but that's just preliminary testing. So any kind of face covering that involves source control, some kind of fabric over your face, meets the requirements of the masking mandates.
Great. Thank you. And I guess, yeah, in the interest of time, we'll unless any urgent questions, David or Kate? No? All right, well, we'll pass it off to Willie Bentz for an update from the Department of Emergency Management. How are we doing, Willie?
Awesome. Thank you, Commissioner. I just have two real kind of quick pieces of news for the update this week. First is that we finally got those child-sized cloth masks into our logistics section late last week. We got 1,540 child-sized masks, which we started delivery late last week, and we'll wrap it up early this week. The KPTG question for the EOC was specifically around those child-sized masks, making sure we had enough as schools started to reopen. Between this shipment coming right in the nick of time from the state EOC, as well as our local mask makers, as well as through commercial vendors, we're pretty confident that we'll be able to equip kids as they go back to school. Of course, I always put out the offer if anyone is unsure of how to get a hold of one of those masks. Obviously, they'll be distributed through the schools, through various local service providers like the adult size masks. But of course, if anyone has nowhere else to turn and doesn't know where to go, they can contact either us at DEM or Public Health, and we'll definitely make sure to get one in your hands. So they're going out this week. Our cloth mask makers are going to continue to focus on child size masks at least through the next week or two, again, just to make sure that all the needs are met as schools start to reopen. The other piece of news, some good news we got from FEMA, is that initially the eligibility window through the Stafford Act, so the Stafford Act is what happens, was what's inactivated. When the president declares an emergency, the Stafford Act reimburses local jurisdictions for eligible disaster costs. Initially, that window for reimbursement was scheduled to close on September 31st. FEMA announced last week that that window will be open now indefinitely. Simply because, again, none of us really know when this is all going to be over. FEMA finally came out and put that into policy. So the eligibility for those reimbursements will go into the future indefinitely. What we still don't know specifically are what those eligible costs are going to be. You know, obviously, this is kind of an unprecedented disaster for a lot of us. FEMA has a kind of core set of reimbursement policies, but they're still actually deciding what specifically is going to be eligible, because, you know, the size and scope of this disaster was really unlike anything FEMA's ever seen before. So the only thing that we know is truly safe in terms of things that we're going to be reimbursed for, PPE for healthcare workers and first responders, really mostly things centered around EOC operations, healthcare, and then first response activities. There are other things like mitigation measures and PPE for essential public services, but ones that weren't necessarily directly interacting with COVID patients, weren't necessarily responding to emergencies, that still may or may not be eligible. So we're really waiting to hear on that, because that'll hopefully mean a lot of money back into the county if FEMA decides to pick up the tab on that. If not, we'll have to find other funding sources for that. But for the time being, FEMA opened that window indefinitely. What specifically is eligible is still TBD. So we'll continue to update on that as we hear more from FEMA. Those are the two big things for me. Again, I know you have a 10:30 here, so I will leave it at that with the exception of any questions.
Great.